Yes.
Yeah, I did delete all this.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get started. So, few announcements. There is a assignment, programming assignment due tomorrow, I believe. There is a homework due on Friday. Okay, so if you have any last minute questions on the programming assignment, do come to the discussion section tomorrow. Okay, there will be some more discussion of this programming assignment as well as material that you need to know for subsequent ones. Excuse me. So keep that in mind. Homework, I don't know if anyone has even looked at it, but if you have questions, please come by, talk to me or the TA. Okay. With respect to the in-class exercises, I'm just wondering if, do you need them back or should I just list how you did on the Spark page? Because we are just doing a binary grading essentially, saying you got it or you didn't. And it's going to be a very small fraction of the overall course grade. I mean, really the real homeworks are the ones that are worth something. The in-class exercises are just things that we hand out to make sure you are keeping up. Okay, so if you want it, I can start handing them out, but there will be several and it might just not be worth the effort. Instead, I'll just put a binary grade saying you got it or not. If you didn't get it, you should just go review the material. That's just indication of something that you missed that you shouldn't have. Okay? So, yes. Actual answer, if you want, I could certainly send the solutions out. That's not a problem. Okay, I can either email it or make it available somehow. Well, the other announcement was the discussion board. I have decided we should actually use the one that is in Spark rather than the one that's on the EdLab. It is equivalent in functionality. And since you're using Spark to hand in assignments, it might be easier to use that. Okay, so I have actually enabled the discussion feature within Spark. So if you log in, you will see that there are some boards there already, one for lectures and one for programming assignments. So go and post any questions you have in there. Yeah, or if you want to start up a discussion of some sort. Okay? So let's get started on today's class. I'm going to do a review. I still have a bunch of these things left over, candies to hand out. If you ask questions, you come to the end of the class and pick one up. I'm not going to throw them at you like last time. Okay, so last time we started talking about processes. So process essentially is a unit of execution. I said it's the dynamic state of a program that is being executed by your machine. The data structure that the operating system kernel maintains to keep track of all of the processes is called the process control block or the PCB. Okay, this data structure keeps track of everything that the OS needs to know about the process. Okay, where is it loaded in memory, who owns the process ID, the resources that are currently being accessed by the process, state of the registers, memory management information, page table. Basically, everything that the OS needs to know is in that data structure. That's one PCB per process in the system. Okay. Then we looked at the different states of the processes. There was a state transition diagram I showed. So a process can either be in new, ready, running, waiting, or terminated states. You should know how the processes can make transition from one state to another. That was the in-class exercise we did. Okay. I talked about this notion of a context switch. Okay. This is the functionality that the OS kernel implements to switch from one process to another. Okay. What happens during a context switch is you save the state of the currently executing process and you load the state of the next process that is ready to run. You take one from the ready queue and you restore its state and it gets to run. Okay? Each process can get to run for a time slice or a quantum. We'll have more to say about that today. Okay? And then towards the end of the class, I was talking about how processes can communicate with one another. Okay, I'm going to resume that discussion before we start talking about threads. Okay, today's discussion, the lecture is really about threads. There's some leftover material from last time that I'll cover first. Okay, so this is the producers and consumers problem. Okay, so I mentioned this last time. So what happens here is there are two processes. There could be more than two, but in the simplest version of producers and consumers, two processes that share a buffer. Okay, there's a process called a producer, there's a process called a consumer. Producer produces some data item, it doesn't matter what it is, it's just a piece of data, and it puts it into the shared buffer. Okay, and the consumer essentially consumes data items from the shared buffer and does some processing based on what the data item is. Okay, so this is the data structure. The shared buffer is a data structure that producer process and the consumer process share. Okay, that's the data structure that they use to communicate between them. Okay, here is one abstract version of the producers and consumers. This one is a bounded buffer. Okay, the n equals 100 says that there are 100 entries in the buffer. Okay, at any point, the buffer can hold at most 100 data items that a producer has produced. So there are two loops, one for the producer, one for the consumer. Essentially, it's an infinite loop where you wait until the producer has to wait if all the slots in the buffer are full, because it has to wait until at least one slot is available before it can insert something into the buffer. So that's the loop that is just checking whether the buffer is full. If not, you wait. And if it's not full, then you can take the data item that you just produced and insert it into the buffer. Okay? This is called a circular buffer. Okay? The way it is actually represented is a circular buffer that is essentially an array that loops. Okay, so once you reach the end of the array, you do a mod n and you come back to the beginning. Okay, so there's a head of the buffer and there's a tail of the buffer. The tail keeps incrementing the head. The head is incrementing and the tail is decrementing. Okay, so that's basically the producer. Consumer is doing the opposite. It's waiting until there is at least one data item in the buffer. If the buffer is empty, which means the head and the tail match, there's nothing in the buffer, then you have to wait. There's at least one data item, then you can go and consume the next one. Okay, and then that's the way it's going to continue. Okay, that's the abstract representation of producers and consumers. The way it is actually implemented in practice, okay, is using either a message passing mechanism or a shared memory mechanism. Okay, we'll look at both instances of producers and consumers. Before I do that, any question about what a producer consumer is? What it does? Okay. So this is the producers and consumers using the message passing paradigm. Okay. So here the code is actually very simple. Okay. What you do is you use this send and receive methods that allow a process to send a message to another process and some other process to receive that message. Okay. Rather than actually implementing a buffer, you are going to implicitly use a buffer. Okay, when you do a send, what happens is you hand in a message to the operating system. The operating system is maintaining this buffer for you. Okay, so you don't have to actually implement the buffer. Okay, the send and receive have a buffer that the OS kernel implements. Whenever you do a send, the OS will actually take the buffer, the message rather, can append it to the buffer. Whenever some process does a receive, the OS will actually go and take an item from the buffer and give it to you. Okay, so this looks like you're sending messages, okay, rather than actually playing with the buffer. You just send a message. So here you send a message, which is the data item you have produced, to this consumer process. Okay, here you do a receive and then you wait for the producer process to send you a message. Okay, so that's all you are going to do in this case. It's a very simple implementation, okay, that you can use using message passing. There's only one other piece of code here, which is you do a fork. Okay, so you will basically have one process acting as the producer and the other process acting as the consumer. Okay, so in this case, it's the parent process that becomes the producer. The child process is the consumer. We will have more to say about send and receive when we do distributed systems and networking. This is exactly the same set of primitives we will use for processes to communicate across machines. Okay, in this case, we have implicitly assumed that these are processes. Well, not implicit, it's explicit here because of the fork. These are processes on the same machine. They're sending messages. Okay? This notion of message passing can actually cross a network boundary. So the consumer can be on some other machine and the producer can be on some machine. You will use the exact same send and receive primitives to do that. Okay, so we will come back to this at a later point in this course. Okay, so I already said distributed systems use this for message passing. The important things to keep in mind, okay, is that the send and the receive need to specify who is the message for and where is the message coming from. Okay, so you need to name the process. Okay, this is like an address that you specify that says this is the destination for this message and it's going to say that that's who the message is from. Okay, if the processes cannot name, then you cannot have the OS connect up this buffer across these producers and consumers. Okay, so you need to be able to name the other process. In this case, you are assuming implicitly that the buffer is infinite. Okay, because there is no code here that is doing checks on the buffer. The buffer is not directly visible to you. It's maintained by the operating system. You can only manipulate the buffer, which means append something or take something using the send and the receive. And the OS is giving you the illusion of an infinite buffer. Okay, so you don't really need to do any checks. Okay, if there was a bounded buffer, okay, which we will see in the next slide, then you have to do extra checks saying before you insert an element, you have to check whether the buffer is full. Okay, otherwise you will override some data element. And before you take some element out, you have to check if the buffer is empty. Okay, because there won't be anything to consume. Okay, so in message passing paradigm, the buffer can be assumed to be infinite. Okay, the OS is giving you that abstraction, but if you implement your own buffer, as we will see, then that's not the case. Okay, the exercise here, which I'm not going to go into, says can you generalize this to single producer, multiple consumers? Okay, this is something for you to think about. We will come back to producers and consumers. Okay, this is not the end of it. When we do synchronization, we look at locks and monitors and mutexes, we will come back to producers and consumers. Okay, so here is another version of the producer-consumer that uses shared memory. Okay. So shared memory is an abstraction that the OS provides you where you can take a piece of RAM and share it across two processes. Okay. The reason this is important is in this picture I showed you this buffer. Okay. And I said both the producer and consumers have access to this buffer. This is a piece of memory. Okay. When you do message passing, that's fine because the buffer is actually implemented inside the kernel. Okay. So you just append something using send and you take something out using receive. But if you have to implement your own shared buffer, then how would you do it? Okay? If you go back two classes back, I said the OS implements protection, which prevents one process, okay, from accessing any memory that belongs to other process. Okay? So if protection is already in place, there is no way for you to directly share memory between two address spaces. Okay? The memory that's allocated to the producer process is not accessible to the consumer process. And vice versa. Okay? If that is the case, then how will you implement a shared buffer if you cannot share memory? Is that clear what the problem is? Okay? The way this is done is using a special feature called shared memory. Okay, as the name suggests, this is a special mechanism that the operating system provides that explicitly allows you to take a piece of RAM and share it between two processes. So this same piece of RAM or the same memory region becomes available in both of these processes. Okay? And then you can implement your shared buffer. Okay? Because then you will allocate an array. Okay, in a shared memory region, and this array becomes available in both the producer and consumer, and then you can add elements to the array in the producer, you can remove elements from the consumer. Okay? But if you do not use shared memory, there is no way for you to do it. Okay? Because there is no way to actually share memory between address spaces because of the protection feature. Okay? If you try to access some other piece of memory, you get a page fault and your process will terminate. Okay. So the way that you allocate shared memory is using, there are multiple techniques actually. There is one system called MMAP, okay, that allows you to do this. There is just a pseudo code that shows you how you can use MMAP. The parameters are not important. The only thing that's important is for you to first use that feature in the process to create a piece of memory that you can share across processes. Okay, so you MMAP some memory region that becomes shared and then you fork here. Okay, then there's a producer process and there's a consumer process. Because there's a shared memory region, it is actually that piece of memory will be shared. Okay? Everything else will be separate. Okay, there will be two cloned processes, but this piece of memory that you allocated is going to be shared, and that is where you will implement your array, okay, which is the array buffer. Okay, that will be stored in that memory region. Okay. That's how you can implement producers and consumers using the shared memory abstraction. There are MMAP is a system call, incidentally. Okay. There are other system calls to also allocate shared memory. This is just one of the many that are available to you. Is that clear, what I just said? Any questions on what shared memory is? Okay, shared memory is a special piece of memory that you explicitly allocate and tell the OS that this one needs to be shared across processes. And need to do it does the necessary tweaks in the page table to make it available. Okay, no other piece of memory of that belongs to a process is accessible to some other process. Okay, the rest of the code is exactly the same. What I showed you earlier, if all you have to do is do the mmap to allocate the shared memory region, then the producer is going to produce a data item, see excuse me, see if the buffer is full. If the buffer is full, it has to wait. If not, it can insert an element and then increment the head. Consumer does the opposite. If the buffer is empty, it has to wait. Otherwise, it takes an element. Any questions on this? Okay, so because you are going to program in Java, you will not directly encounter shared memory. Okay, because this is something that's a system call. You typically do deal with this in a C or C++ program, but it's something that you should know. Okay, otherwise, there's no direct way to implement producers and consumers using different processes. Okay, later on today, we will actually see a version of producers and consumers that use threads. Okay. And there you don't need shared memory for other reasons, that because the address space will be shared. But if you need processes to send messages and you want to explicitly use a buffer, you have to use shared memory. Okay, so that's producers and consumers. We'll keep coming back to this several times throughout the course. But what we want to do now is focus on threads. Okay, so we will, I'll first introduce what are threads. Explain the concept, okay? And then we'll look at how do we implement threads. Okay? Are they implemented in the kernel? Does the OS need to do something about threads? Are they implemented as a library? Okay? And then what features does the OS need to provide? And then if I have time, I'm going to start this next topic, which is how do you go about scheduling either threads or processes on the CPU? Okay? That's CPU scheduling. Okay, so let's start with what are threads. So we know what a process is. A process is basically a program in execution. Okay. Now what is a thread? A thread is basically a sequential execution stream within an address space. Okay. This is the set of instructions that a process is executing is its execution stream. Okay. It's a sequential execution stream, and basically that's what is called a thread of control that runs through an address space. Okay. Typically any process that you have has one execution stream. That's where the program counter is currently pointing. That's the instruction that's being executed. And then the program counter increments, and then you keep executing subsequent instructions. That's a sequence of instructions that process is executing. Okay? Those sequence of instructions are referred to as the thread of control. Okay? Because that's what the process is doing. Okay? Now what threads do when we say threads is basically they take this notion of a sequential execution stream and the address space and decouple them. Okay, so address space is basically now a region of memory. So let me draw a picture here. Okay, so let's assume this is your process. Okay, that's just heap. Stack goes upward. This is the code segment, and there is some instructions here. And let's say that's the program counter. And the program counter keeps incrementing; it keeps executing this code. That's what is referred as a thread of control. This is the address space of the process, as the region of memory. In a process, the two are exactly the same. There is one thread of control in one address space. Okay. Threads generalize this notion and allow you to have multiple threads of control through the same address space. Okay? So what this means is it's equivalent to saying there are different parts of the program that are concurrently being executed by separate execution streams. Okay? So if in this case you might have the main function, you might have the foo function. There could be another thread of control. This thread of control, which is a program counter, is executing this code. Okay, in the same address space, this thread of control is executing this code. Okay, and these are proceeding independently of one another. Okay, each is sequential, and you can have as many of these as you want. All of these threads of controls actually share the same address space. Okay, they are executing different pieces of the program within the same address space. Okay, that is essentially what a thread is. Okay, the threads extract the thread of control information from the process. You can have multiple threads bound to the same process. Okay, so each process now may have multiple threads of control in them. The address space is shared. Okay, and this is, I will see that why this allows you to do cooperation and coordination without doing shared memory or message passing and so on. Okay, but we'll come back to that. Let me show you a picture here. Okay, this is your traditional process. Okay, which now is also equivalent to what we will call a single threaded process. By a process, we mean an address space with a single thread of control. Okay, that's your code, that's the data, those are files, those are the registers and the stack, and there's one thread of control that's executing some code. This is a multi-threaded process. Okay, code, data and files are shared. Okay, there's only one of those. Okay, but each thread gets its own registers. Each thread gets its own stack. Okay, so that is, this is separate from the registers and stack that this thread has and that thread has. Okay, and each is executing a different piece of that code. Okay, as I've shown you here. Okay, this thread will have its own stack, but this executing this part of the code, this thread is executing that other part of the code. Okay, and then you could have one more that's executing something else. Okay, and each gets their own stack, so that piece is actually replicated. Heap is shared. Okay, there's no separate heap. Heap is going to be shared, but stack and the registers are unique to each thread. Okay, is this concept clear, what I just said? Any questions on this? Okay, so let me just show you. So if you take a typical program today, okay, you will either get this, okay, the process, you'll either get this or this. Okay, so you can examine any typical process on your system to see whether it has one or multiple threads. Okay, let's just take, okay, so these are all the processes that are running on this machine. And there's a column here that tells you how many threads there are, okay, within each process. Let's just look at, let's sort it. Okay, so the first few, actually there are only two. Okay, so you'll see that the first two have only one thread. Okay, that is what we'll call a typical process. Okay, that has only one thread of control. So typically when you write a program, or any program that you may have written until now, would correspond to this process. It has only one thread of control, that's the only thing that's executing. But you'll see most modern applications have at least two or more threads. Okay, so these are all multi-threaded applications. Okay, so if you take, let's look at Safari for instance. Okay, so here is Safari. This is a browser, 10 threads. Okay, each tab you open will start up more threads. Okay, because each thread is then basically looking at what a tab is and what is in the tab and rendering pages within the tab. Some threads may be fetching data over the network for HTTP requests. Some other threads may be rendering on the screen. So each thread is doing something different within the process. Okay, so you can see that PowerPoint seems to have six threads. Don't know what they do, but there are six of them. Okay. So there are multiple of these. So you will see that most modern applications are written in a multi-threaded fashion. There's a reason for this. Okay, I haven't said why threads make sense. I only introduced this notion of what a thread is. Okay, so then we have to ask, what can you do with it? Okay, so we'll wait on that until we have some more background on threads. Okay, is this clear? What is a thread? Okay, so now let's talk a little more about different types of threaded systems and so on. Okay, so there have been different operating system platforms that support the notion of threads in different ways. Okay. The DOS, MS-DOS, which was a very old operating system, did something very primitive. There was only one address space through the whole system. There was only one thread of control. Okay, so you couldn't even start multiple processes here. Single process, single thread of control. Okay, no support for what we call modern threads at all. Okay. subsequent versions, early versions of Unix allowed multiple processes to run, but didn't really support the notion of threads. Okay, you could only run processes. Each process had your typical one thread of control, the programs that you write typically. Those are the only type of programs you could run. Okay. Here is another interesting platform. These are embedded systems. These are low-end platforms, okay, that allow you to only run one address space at a time. Okay, this box represents an address space. But they are better than MS-DOS in that they allow multiple threads to run within that address space. Okay, so one program at a time, but multiple processes can run. Or not multiple processes, multiple threads can run or execute on the within that address space. Okay, that's what any modern operating system looks like. Okay, multiple processes, potentially multiple threads within each process. I just showed you an example on the Mac. So here's one single threaded process, two threads, three threads, and so on. So that's basically a modern system. This is what embedded systems do. Okay, many phone-like operating systems like Palm OS and so on do this. Okay, they don't support multitasking. You can't run multiple processes at once, but each process can have multiple threads. Okay, so those are older platforms. They don't exist today. So that's basically how systems have evolved over time. Okay, so there can be one or more address spaces supported, and within each address space you could either support a single threaded model or a multi-threaded model. Okay, now let's look at some examples. Okay, this is our producers and consumers using threads. Okay, I showed you producers and consumers using processes. Okay, this is the same application that uses threads. Yeah, so before I even talk about it, why would you use threads to write your producers and consumers? What becomes easier if you have threads? Yes. Okay, so each thread can look at different parameters. Good. Okay, shared memory, what does that mean?
You don't need to have a separate implementation for the shared operation.
Okay, you don't need to have different, we'll come back to that just a second, yes.
If one of them gets caught in something, they also switch to the other one.
Okay, good. So if one of them is waiting or gets blocked, you can run some other application. So all good ideas, and those are all actually some advantages. So we said, if there are multiple execution streams here, okay, if one of them blocks, okay, if you have a single threaded process, if that thread blocks on any IO, the process as a whole has to wait. It cannot make any progress, okay, until the IO completes. Okay. But if you have multiple threads through the same address space, if this thread blocks, okay, this thread may be still runnable. Okay, so your OS can actually switch and start executing this thread. So the process as a whole can continue to make progress even if some threads are waiting on IO. Okay? So you get what is called concurrency. Okay, the program continues to make progress. There's concurrent threads of execution. So some threads may be blocked and others can continue executing. Okay? That's one thing. The other thing that was mentioned, which is very important, is this threads all share the same address space. Which essentially means these threads all have access to all the data structures within this program, because it's the same piece of memory. Okay? So that makes it much easier to implement things like producers and consumers. There is no need to do shared memory. Memory is already shared by definition because all of these threads are executing within the same program. So if you declare a global array in this program, by definition it's going to be available automatically to all the threads. Okay, so you can have shared data structures of any kind within your program that become accessible to all of the threads, and then these shared data structures can be used to implement useful features. Okay, in this case, we will have a shared buffer. Okay, so you have a global buffer there. Okay, that's the first line of the program. That becomes your shared memory. Okay, you don't explicitly share memory across processes. This is the same process. There's multiple threads running through the same process, and you are going to use that buffer. Okay, which is just a local array, not local, but a global array within your process. Is that clear? What sharing of address space gives you? It allows you to access to all the data structures within your program. So here is your producer, here is your consumer, each of them is a thread. We have this abstract call called fork thread. That's not a real call, no thread library supports it, but just think of it as a call that will start off a thread. We'll see how that call is implemented in Java and C++ shortly. And that's your producer, that's your consumer. That code looks exactly the same. That's what the program memory layout looks like. This is the RAM for this program. This is your code segment. That's this code. The producer is executing this loop. The consumer is executing this loop. Same process. So there are two program counters here. One is executing the producer loop. One is executing the consumer loop. You can see that there are two stacks here. There's a stack pointer for thread 1. The stack is growing up here, and this is the stack for thread 2. That stack is also growing. So there are independent stacks, there are independent registers because they have their own program counter. But the heap is shared and global variables are shared. That's global variables there. That buffer there is actually stored in there. So it's accessible to this thread as well as that thread. So you can just go access the buffer and put something in it or take something out of the buffer. Is that clear? Okay. So that's basically how you can use threads to implement your producers and consumers. You can see that this has simplified your application. You don't need to tell the OS about sharing memory. Okay? And you can just use a single process and implement the notion of a producer and consumer. You can fork as many threads as you want. Okay, so there could be multiple producers and multiple consumers. Okay. We will see multiple producer, multiple consumer examples later on in this course. So now let's come to how these threads are actually implemented. Okay. There are two types of threads broadly. One are called kernel threads or kernel level threads. And then the other one are called user threads and user level threads. Okay. Let's start with kernel threads. Okay. As the name suggests, kernel threads are threads that the kernel knows about. Okay, these are visible to the operating system. So when your process starts up, the operating system knows how many threads exist within that process. Okay, the example I was showing you on Mac OS X clearly is a kernel level threads implementation. Okay, so I showed you each process and I could this pro application could tell you how many threads are running within that process. Okay. So this is what kernel level threads are. Okay, so kernel knows about them, kernel supports them. Okay, so what do you get by doing all of this? So one thing it does is, since the kernel knows about threads, it can actually do intelligent scheduling. Okay, it can do context switches between threads. Okay, and it turns out that doing a context switch between threads of the same process is much cheaper than doing context switches between two independent processes. Okay, let me repeat what I just said. Context switching between processes is a more heavyweight operation, more expensive than context switching between threads. Okay. Now, why might that be the case? Yes. Okay, they share the address space. That's good. So why does that fact that they share address space makes the context switch cheaper, more efficient? Okay, so the thread that is you are going to run next is going to continue to access the same address space. Okay, but you are right, but then we have to come back and think about what that means from a context switch perspective. Okay, so what is a context switch? Context switch is a process of saving the state of one task, let's say it's a process, and restoring the state of another. Okay, typically this means you will save all the registers, you will save the memory management information, and you will save all of those things that were fields within your process control block. Okay. Now, if you are switching between threads, the only thing you need to save are the state of the registers. Okay. There is no reason to save the memory management information because that's going to be wasted work. The next thread, if that thread belongs to the same process, has the same information. It's the same address space, so why bother saving the memory state and restoring the same memory state back? Okay. The only thing that is, because these two, suppose you are switching from this thread to this, okay, producer to consumer, they share the same address space. They will have the same memory management information, same page tables and so on. If these are threads across different processes, you would have to save not only the register state but the memory management information as well. Okay. But if you are switching between these two, all you have to do is save the state, the stack pointers and the register values of this thread, and load the state of this other thread, and it's ready to run because they are sharing the same address space. Okay. So fewer things need to be saved and restored when you are switching between threads of the within the same address space. Okay. As a result, context switching between threads is much more efficient than context switching between processes. So this makes it more efficient to run, okay, because context switching is bookkeeping overhead. Okay. The system is not doing anything useful. Okay, it's just trying to save and restore. Nothing is happening. Nothing useful is happening on the machine. Okay. The smaller your context switch overhead, the more useful work you can get done on your system. Okay, so a multi-threaded process by definition will have higher throughput than a multi-process application, because the context switch overhead will be lower on a multi-process or a multi-threaded system. Okay, so that's what is said here. Memory management information does not need to be changed, so no need to save and restore it. Okay, so that's one interesting. Now the kernel must still manage and schedule threads. Okay, and we'll come back to this issue when we talk about user level threads. Okay, just hold off on that for just a moment. Okay, so it's a basic point is switching between kernel threads faster than switching between processes. So if you wrote your producers and consumers using shared memory, which is a multi-process version of producers and consumers, less efficient than the multi-threaded implementation I just showed you, okay, in a kernel threads model. Okay, now let's talk about user level threads. So as the name suggests, a user level thread is a thread that the OS does not know about, not visible to the kernel. Okay, kernel cannot tell. As far as the kernel can see, it looks like one process, and the kernel assumes there's only one thread of control. Okay? But really what has happened is there's a user level library that is creating multiple threads of control within that process. It is just that these threads are not visible to the underlying kernel. Okay? The kernel just treats this application as if it were a single threaded traditional process, because the threads are not visible to it. Okay? So why implement threads in this way? Okay. So the OS only knows about the process, doesn't know anything about the threads. Okay. Why would you ever use a user level library to implement your threads as opposed to using a kernel level threads package? Is there any advantage you can think of? Yes.
Well, then you have no kernel overhead of the kernel deciding whether to switch threads, and if your application doesn't need to, you just don't.
Okay, that's good. So there's no kernel overhead at all if the kernel doesn't know about it. Okay, that's absolutely true. Okay, that's one advantage. Any other reasons why you might use user level threads? So what if you had a platform that doesn't support kernel level threads, and you wanted to write a multi-threaded application? Let's take MS-DOS. Okay? The most primitive operating system that you can come up with, single process on one thread of control, kernel doesn't support threads. Okay, now you want to implement a multi-threaded application that runs on MS-DOS. What would you do? Kernel doesn't support it, you're out of luck. True. Well, you implement it as a user level library. The kernel doesn't support it, but you can implement it at a user level. You can still write multi-threaded applications. Kernel doesn't know about them. In this case, the kernel doesn't even support them. Okay. So one advantage of user level threads is that it can actually, you can write multi-threaded applications on platforms that do not support threads at a kernel level. Okay. First advantage. Another advantage is that if you are using a threads library, okay, you can use whichever library you want for your application. Okay. Different libraries may provide different features. Okay, we'll see that there may be ways that you create thread, there may be ways you schedule thread. If you don't like library 1 that implements a certain way certain type of thread, you can go and pick another library. You can write your own library. Okay? It gives you full control. You are not bound by how this platform implements threads in the kernel level. You can implement your own threads package. You can take existing ones, modify them, because they are all. This is all done at a user level. Okay? There isn't any problem. So different applications can use different threads libraries that provide different functionality. Yes, question.
Let's say you have you're using kernel level threads, and you have multiple processes that are using the kernel threads. How does the kernel manage all the different threads of different processes?
Okay. Yep. So question is, you have kernel level threads. Each process has a different number of threads. How does the kernel manage? That's the question. Okay. So kernel knows about processes. Okay, using the process control block. The process control block for a multi-threaded application has to have thread-specific information. Okay, the process control block that I showed you last time was a PCB for a traditional single-threaded process. So in this case, you can think of a process control block as having all of that information saying where is the memory for this process, and there are entries for each thread within the PCB. That's how the kernel actually knows about thread. There are entries within the process control block, one per thread. So that thread one will have its own register information, own stack information and all of that, and the thread two will have the same thing. So what the kernel knows is about which processes are running. It knows about which threads, how many threads exist and which threads are those. Okay. So now it can do interesting things. It can say, okay, here is a thread that might have, rather here is a process that let's say has 100 threads. Okay. And here's a process that has one thread. Okay. It can figure out how much CPU time to give to that process and this process. Okay. If this process has 100 threads, perhaps it should get lot more CPU time than that process because there is lot more things that are executing concurrently. Okay. Because it knows about which threads are present within a process, it can make these scheduling decisions. We haven't talked about CPU scheduling yet, but those are the kinds of things you can actually do within the process. Okay. So you can make these decisions. You know about which, you not only do you pick a thread process to run, you actually can pick which thread within that process gets to run on the CPU. Okay, by saying this is the one I'm going to restore the state of its registers, and then that thread gets to run. So you can actually make all of these decisions. Is that what you were asking, or you were asking something else?
Well, yeah, also, like, you're going to have, you need, every thread needs, you know, queues. And so will the kernel have to create all these different queues for a different process, or will it throw all these threads in one big queue?
Mm. Okay, so you're talking about the queues that are associated with each state?
Yeah, the wait queue.
Right. So essentially what happens here is the thread is this entity that is being scheduled for execution. So really you don't have a process, you don't have these queues for each process, you have just a queue of threads. So it's rather there. So you don't distinguish between queues across, or rather you don't distinguish between processes. So each queue in this case is just one thread. Okay, so you can just pick which thread to run. That's basically the generalization. You don't schedule processes, you start scheduling threads. So you just treat this as one pool of, I guess there are 9 threads here. So you just pick one thread from this 9, and some threads will be on the ready queue and some will be on the wait queue. Yes.
So are the CPU time slices split among threads and not processors?
If you have multi-threaded kernel level threads, you will actually allocate CPU time to threads, not to processes. So when you get a quantum, you will allocate that to a single thread within that process. Any other questions on this? So whatever you used to do for processes, now you start doing for thread. That's the way to think about kernel level threads. Okay? Now this discussion should also tell you something about user level threads. User level threads, the advantage of user level threads is that if the kernel doesn't support it, you can still get a threads library and write multi-threaded applications, okay? Which is great, okay? Because you've gotten around some limitations of what your kernel is willing to provide you. Okay? We also said that it is more efficient to do context switching of user level threads, okay, than kernel level threads. Okay? The reason for this is context switching of user level threads is a library function. It's not a system call. Kernel is not doing the saving and restoring of register. It's a thread. It's the threads library that's doing it. Okay, so you can just switch between threads using simple function calls that are made to the threads library. rather than doing having to suspend the process and have the kernel run and do things. Okay? So context switching of user level threads, order of magnitude faster than context switching between kernel level threads. Okay? And kernel level threads are themselves faster than context switching between processes. Okay? Now the disadvantage. Okay, so here is a picture. So as far as the OS, this is user level threads, right? So these are actual applications and those are threads within those applications. Okay, that's the address space and these are threads. As far as the OS is concerned, it only sees one address space and it looks like a traditional process. It doesn't know that there are three threads there and one thread here and four threads there. Okay? So from a scheduling perspective, there is a disadvantage. Okay? Because the OS doesn't really know how many threads exist within each application. So it cannot decide which thread or which process to give CPU time. It treats all of these applications as a black box of a single threaded process. Okay? So in this case, this application may get the same CPU time as that application, although it has four times as many threads as this application. Okay? So your process might not get the CPU time it desires because the OS doesn't know. It cannot make any better decisions. Okay. In kernel level threads, it would know that there are three threads there and it would be actually scheduling those threads. So this might actually get, this process as a whole, they get three times as much CPU time as a single threaded process. Yes, question.
Can you, in C++, can you do
like P-thread, is that a user or is that kernel? Okay. The question is, if in P-threads, P-thread is a library package, we'll talk about that in just a moment, is that user level threads or kernel level threads? So pthreads is actually an API. It's an interface. A set of functions and APIs that are defined. The pthread specification does not specify whether to use kernel level or user level threads. You can get pthreads libraries that are implemented as user level threads. You can get pthreads libraries that are implemented as kernel level threads. Okay? By default, what you get, let's say on Linux or Mac or even a Windows implementation, will be kernel level threads because the kernel is already supporting threads. Okay? So you write a pthread library that makes use of kernel level threads, but that need not be the case. You can just go and actually get pthread library for the same platform that are built using user level threads. Okay? So that's just an API. It doesn't specify which to use. So by default, you may be using a kernel level threads version of pthread. Okay, so here is, as I said, here is the ready queue of these processes. It doesn't know how many threads exist, so that's going to be a disadvantage of user level threads. Okay, so I already mentioned this. Let's recap the advantages. Advantages of user level threads, there's no context switch that the kernel has to perform when it switches between one user level thread to another one within the same process. This is a library call. Okay, there's a scheduler in the threads library that is going to pick which thread to run. All that the OS is saying is it will pick process A for execution. Once it picks process A, then the user level threads library will run and say which user level thread to actually execute on the CPU. Okay? So this thread scheduling is more flexible. You can choose whichever library you want. Okay? You can implement different scheduling algorithms that say this is how threads within this process should be scheduled. Okay, if you don't like scheduling algorithm A, you can pick a different threads library. Okay, you can change the scheduling algorithm without touching the kernel at all. Okay, so it gives you a lot more flexibility of how to go about scheduling threads. Okay, thread can voluntarily give up the CPU and then some other thread can run. Okay, so other thing is user level threads do not require system calls to create them. Okay, you just make a call to the library, okay, thread create, okay, and then it will create a thread. Okay, without even having to go to the operating system. Because the OS doesn't know, doesn't care. Okay? All the threads library is managing. Okay, so the basic point that comes out of all of this is user level threads much faster and more efficient than kernel level threads. Okay, because everything is managed within user space by a library. Okay? And this is also the main disadvantage of user level threads, that because everything is managed in user space within a library, the kernel doesn't know about them. So whenever the kernel needs to make decisions, it cannot make intelligent decisions. Okay, in particular, it doesn't know how many threads the process has. It cannot allocate CPU time accordingly. More problematic is the fact that if one user level thread blocks, the process as a whole is going to block. Okay? If this user level threads, if the producer or the in the producer consumer case, the producer does any IO, okay, saying I inserted one element in the buffer, let's say you just want to print this message, okay, the entire process will block. Because there is only one process, as far as the OS knows, it sees that the process is trying to do IO. It doesn't know, the kernel doesn't know that there are other threads there that might be ready to run. Because it blocks the whole process. In kernel level threads, each is an independent thread that the kernel knows about. Okay? So if the producer starts doing IO, only the producer thread actually goes into the wait queue. Okay? In this case, the consumer thread can still stay on the ready queue and run at some point and make progress. Okay. That's a big disadvantage. Okay. So in a user level thread, if one user level thread waits for IO, the whole process block. That's not true for kernel level threads. Okay, so that's what I was saying. Anything that the OS needs to know about threads will become a disadvantage here. That's scheduling, IO, all of those are problematic. Okay. So OS is basically going to treat it as a single threaded process. So those are some advantages and disadvantages of user level threads and kernel level threads. Every disadvantage of a user level thread is an advantage of a kernel level thread. Every advantage of a kernel level thread is a disadvantage of a user level thread. Okay, so that's, just keep that in mind. So you just have to flip it between the two and this become advantages and disadvantages. Is that clear? Is there any other question there on user and kernel level threads? So I was going to now mention one more concept. Okay, that concept is called a lightweight process. Okay, so typically most operating systems will support kernel level threads, some won't, and then what you get there probably are user level threads if you have a threads library. Okay, now what some operating systems like Solaris, okay, this is Sun's microsystems operating system, do is they use a hybrid model. Okay, this is called a lightweight process. Okay. So in this case, what happens is there is an address space. Okay. Within the address space, the operating system kernel supports this notion of a lightweight process called LWP. Okay. So lightweight process is an entity that the kernel knows about. Okay. And the kernel can schedule. Okay. And what the kernel does is supports a user level threads package. So there's a kernel level thing that the kernel knows about, and there's also a user level threads package that can actually take threads and map them in arbitrary ways to a lightweight process. Okay? Mapping can be one to one, many to many, or many to one. Okay, so here is an example of a lightweight. So that's an address space, that's a process. Okay? These circles here are lightweight processes. These are things that the kernel know about and can schedule. Okay? That's a thread within the process. That thread is mapped on to this lightweight process. Okay? What mapping on means is whenever this lightweight process is scheduled for execution, that thread is going to run. Okay? This is one-to-one mapping. Okay? Here is a two-to-one mapping. Okay? That's also another lightweight process kernel knows about. Okay? There are two user-level threads that are mapped on to that lightweight process. Okay? Now if the kernel chooses this lightweight process for execution, there's some decision, additional decision you have to make at a user level. Okay, so you call the user level library saying this lightweight process is ready for execution. Which of those two threads that you have mapped onto this lightweight process should be actually executing? Okay, so the user level threads library will pick one of those two and actually execute them. Okay, so here is one where there are many-to-many mapping. There is a single thread that's mapped onto multiple lightweight processes. So when this one runs, one thread can run, and when that one runs, this you can pick that or some other thread for execution. Okay. So this makes it more flexible as far as the operating system is concerned to have a mapping from what the user level program is doing and what the kernel needs to know from a scheduling standpoint. Okay. So I'll have something to say about this on the next slide as well. So that brings us, so if you generalize this concept, okay, that gives you different types of threading models. Okay. Here is a many-to-one threading model. Okay? Here is a one-to-one threading model. There's one kernel, one thing in the kernel that the kernel knows about. There's one user level, one thread that's mapped onto that. Here there are multiple threads that are mapped onto something that the kernel knows about. This is a many-to-many model. That's a hybrid model. Okay, now let's go back to everything we have discussed and try to place them into these four categories. Okay. What is a user level thread going to map onto? Which model does a user level threads package pick? Yes. So the claim is user level threads is a many to one model. Is that true? Anybody agree or disagree with it? Yes. Yeah, you agree. Anybody disagree with it? Okay, why is it a many to one model? Yes. Okay, so that's basically what we just said. That there's only one thing that the kernel knows about, that's the process. Okay, there are multiple user level threads. Okay, they're all mapped onto this one thing. Okay, so kernel can only pick this thing for execution, and it doesn't really know about the presence of those four threads. So that's why user level threads packages are basically many to one mappings. Okay? Kernel level thread package, as it might be clear by now, is basically a one to one mapping. Okay? For every thread there is something that the kernel knows about, the presence of that thread. So the kernel can actually choose this thing for execution, and that thread will actually execute as a result of that decision. Okay? So that's kernel level threads, one to one, the user level threads. Okay. If you generalize this notion, if you get something like this, okay, or the OS actually allows you to choose a mapping, you get one of these models. Okay. In Solaris, you actually get to pick. Okay. Whenever you do a thread create, you can pass an additional argument to thread create, saying map create a new lightweight process and map it to that lightweight process, in which case a new kernel level thread gets created, a lightweight process gets created, and the thread gets mapped onto this. Or if you don't specify that, what the OS will do is it will try to automatically map it to one of the existing ones. Okay. So you can actually not only control how many schedulable entities the kernel knows about, you can also control the mapping from all the threads you have within your process to particular lightweight processes. So then you can carefully control how much CPU time you get. Okay, so in this case, every time this thing runs, that thing will run. Here, basically, you basically take the CPU time that these three kernel, these three lightweight processes get, and partition it across four user level threads. Okay? So each of them is basically going to get 3/4 of the total CPU time that this one is going to get. Okay? So it's a more flexible model. Yeah, that Solaris and other operating systems support. Okay? By default, Linux is only supports that for kernel level threads model. So it doesn't allow you to create lightweight processes in this flexible thing. It just says create a kernel level thread, and there's one user level thread gets mapped onto it. Okay, there are platforms, if they don't support any kernel level threads and you want to do multi-threaded programming, this is what you're stuck with. But there are keep in mind that there will be platforms like that. Okay. So what these platforms do is also what is called a two-level scheduling. Okay. Whenever you have this arbitrary mappings, there are two types of scheduling decision. A kernel has to make a decision, say, which lightweight process to run. Okay? And if there are multiple threads mapped onto that lightweight process, the user level library then has to pick a particular user thread to actually run on the CPU. Okay? It's called a two-level scheduling model. Okay? In a kernel level thread, there is no such decision to be made because there's only one thread mapped. So as soon as a particular lightweight process or a kernel level thread gets chosen, that thread gets to execute. There's no other decision to make. Okay? The user level threads, there's already a two-level model because the kernel is only picking that process and all the decisions are actually being made within a thread scheduler. Okay? The same thing is true in a many-to-many model as well. Any questions on this? Yes. Why is it called as a lightweight process? Because it's basically a kernel level thread, okay? But because multiple user level processes could get mapped on it, they came up with this term saying it is more lightweight than a process. For the same reason, context switching between kernel threads is more lightweight operation than context switching between processes. The same is true here. A lightweight process is nothing but a kernel level thread on which multiple user level threads are mapped. But that's essentially what it is. But to distinguish it from what we know of a kernel level thread, they just came up with a different term. Okay, it's just a kernel level thread that has multiple user level threads that are mapped onto it. That's all it is. You know, that's just a terminology thing. Okay. Incidentally, the notion of a lightweight process was what eventually got generalized to pthreads. The lightweight processes was Solaris implementation of threads. Okay. And then they actually got it standardized as pthreads. Okay, but pthreads are more flexible. You can use any model to implement a 3 pthreads library. But if you look at the lightweight process calls within Solaris, okay, and you look at the pthreads call, they are actually, most of the API is more or less identical. Okay. So with that background on user level threads, kernel level threads and lightweight processes, we're going to now present some APIs or libraries that typically are used in practice, okay, to write multi-threaded applications. Okay. So threads library provide APIs for creating and managing threads. Okay, and I already mentioned the library could be implemented completely in user space or it could use kernel level support. Okay, so there are three that I'll talk about: pthreads, Windows threads, and Java threads. Okay. Pthreads is a POSIX standard. Okay, if you implement a multi-threaded application in C or C++, you will use the pthreads library to write your multi-threaded code. Okay. I'll show you some examples of pthread code in just a moment. Okay. So this API specifies the behavior of threads, how to create threads, how to delete threads, how to do synchronization between threads. All of this is implemented, okay, using the pthreads API. Okay. It specifies this layer. And once you write an application using the pthreads API, any platform that supports the pthread API will run your application. Okay, so if you write using pthread, the same code, so long as you can compile it, okay, it will run on Solaris, Linux, it will run on OS X. So all of them support pthreads. It's a widely used package for implementing threads application. Okay, Win32 threads, okay, are Windows implementation of threads. Okay, there's a similar API, not the same. Okay, so you will actually have to, if you want to go from pthreads and you want to run that on Windows, your choices are either look for a POSIX implementation of threads on Windows, okay, there are some, you have to buy them, okay, or what comes out of the box will be Win32 threads. So you will have to go into the code and make modifications to change all the threading calls to this API. Okay, but the API is similar, there's facility to create thread, delete thread, do synchronization, and so on. Okay, so this is stuck. Okay. Okay. So the thing that you will actually use in this class will be for your programming assignments are Java threads. Okay. So this is the notion of threads that are implemented in the JVM. Okay, the Java Virtual Machine implements threads. Threads are actually supported at the language level in Java. Okay. In C and C++, is not a language level construct. Okay, it's a library that provides you this threading mechanism. In Java, it's supported out of the box in the language. So any JVM, so if you, once you write your pro application using Java thread, it will run on any JVM. Okay, because it's using this API that's supported on all of the JVM. Okay. Now, you can ask whether Java threads use user level threads or kernel level threads. Right, so the answer is it depends. If your JVM is running on a platform that does not have level, kernel level thread support, then the only thing that the JVM can do is use a threads user level library. Okay, so it actually implements the threads library. Okay, that threads library exposes the Java threads API. API does not change. How threads are implemented in the JVM changes. Okay, on the other hand, if you are writing a JVM for a platform that actually has kernel level thread support, then JVM can directly use those kernel level threads. Okay. Now if you actually trace the history of Java, it turns out that early versions of JVMs, okay, implemented Java threads using user level threads. Okay, they didn't make any assumptions about which platform supports what. Okay, the same code base could actually be compiled on multiple platforms because you didn't really need to, code base meaning the JVM code, not the application code. So you didn't need any support. Okay, to make things more efficient or better, more modern versions of JVMs actually you implement Java thread using kernel level threads. Okay, so today if you actually take any JVM on Linux or OS X or any platform like this, you will probably have a JVM implementation that uses a kernel level threads package to implement your Java threads API. Okay, now there are, I'll show you some code here. There are multiple thread classes within Java, okay, that basically you need to use to implement threads. Okay, so here is the easiest thing to do is actually go and read the concurrency tutorial on Java. Okay, so that basically is a tutorial that exposes all this notion that we've been talking about. I'll show you what I was just saying about runnable in threads. Okay, so here are some sample code that implements Java threads. So you can actually use this runnable interface to write your threads package, or you can just extend the thread class directly. In either of the two cases, what you need to do is you need to have a run function within your code that implements the code for the thread. Okay? So the run function is actually what the thread is going to execute. In this case, the thread only executes one line which says hello. Okay? Same is true here. But whatever, so if you are doing producers and consumers, you will actually implement the producer-consumer code within the run function. Okay? And then this is how you start the thread. Okay, so in this case, you basically call the thread, we create a new instance of the thread object, and you call start. Okay? And you tell it that it has to actually run that code, which means that it will start a new thread, it will go and execute the run function. Okay? So you can either start threads using this implements runnable, or you can just extend the threads package directly and do the same thing. We'll have to create a new instance of this class and this call start. It will also create a thread, and it will start executing this code. Okay. There will be more on this in a discussion section. Okay, just to introduce this notion of a thread. Here I just wanted to point to the fact that there is a nice tutorial which will give you a quick overview of how to use threads in Java if you haven't done so. And then the other thing is how to start threads. This is how you will actually start a thread. Okay, that's the Java API for threads. Yeah, so there are two ways I said. You can extend the threads class and implement the runnable interface. Okay, so these are sample code in three different platforms. Okay, you will use pthreads create in C or C++ to create threads. There are other things there that set attributes for the threads, etc. Okay, this is Win32. You use the create thread API. Okay, very similar to pthreads, but so you will basically give a thread ID, you will tell which function to execute and so on. Okay? Same thing in Java. Yeah, I just said you create a new thread and then you call thread.start to start that thread. Okay? And that will then execute that code in that which is written in the run function in that class. Okay, just small snippets. You will actually in this class we'll focus only on Java thread. Okay, no need to worry about pthreads or Win32 threads. Okay, and there will be more on that in the discussion section. Any questions on this? On Java threads or any other aspects? Okay. So I have about 5 or maybe 10 minutes left. So I'm going to now introduce this notion of scheduling. Yeah, that's actually the next subtopic within this processes and threads component of the course. Okay. So what is this scheduling of processes and threads? Why do we care about it? Okay, we already mentioned that you have this multiple execution states of any process or threads. Okay, and then each of them is implemented as a queue of process control blocks, and the processes transition from one state to another. Okay. And then the focus of the scheduling component is the transition from ready to running. If there is a queue of threads or processes here, okay, which one should the OS pick to actually run on the processor? How long should it run on that processor, and then which one should be picked next? Okay. The decision for this is implemented in a component called the CPU scheduler. Within the operating system kernel, the CPU scheduler has some policies. The policies dictate which thread gets to run next, how much time they spend on the CPU. Okay? There will be a range of policies, as you will see. Okay? And particular operating systems will implement some, but not all of those policies. These policies will have different properties. Okay? So depending on what behavior you want for your applications, your operating system kernel, like the OS designer, has to pick the right scheduling policy. Okay, so what we are going to do in this component is to understand, okay, how CPU scheduling works and what these policies are. Okay, so today is just going to be a quick introduction. We'll come back to this next time and we'll look at this in more detail. Okay, so it is just some high level concept. There are two types of scheduling decisions. Okay, one is called long term scheduling and then the other one is called short term scheduling. Okay, long term scheduling essentially is the decision that the kernel makes that says how many processes can execute concurrently in the system. Okay, should I let 100 processes, should I let 1000 processes run? Where do I say that there are enough processes, no more can be started? That is called long term scheduling. Okay, it's the number of jobs that are currently running, okay, in the system. Okay, so when I started this activity monitor, this says that let's go back to that. Okay, so how many processes are there here? There are 59 processes, okay, 293 threads currently running. Okay, I can start as many as I want. I could start 10 new applications, more will start. Okay, when should the operating system says enough, you cannot start anymore, there aren't enough resources to do anything more? Okay, that is called long term scheduling. There is going to be a limit. Okay, typically you do not hit that limit. Okay, but if you actually just start, the trivial thing to find out that limit is start, write an application that has an infinite loop that just keeps doing fork. Okay, at some point this application will basically fork, will start returning an error. That's where the operating system said there are enough processes, I can't run anymore. Okay, I have enough entries in the process control block, you have reached, maxed out the limit on the number of processes. Okay, how is that process limit chosen? That decision is referred to as a long-term scheduling problem. Okay, and typically that depends, the limit is chosen based on the number of resources you have. How much memory do you have? Okay, how many processors are there on the system? That will dictate. At some point, starting more processes, there are already so many processes that the system is already groaning under the load. There isn't any point in starting more. Okay? At that point, the OS is going to basically invoke that limit and prevent creation of additional processes. Okay? So the answer is there is a limit, but it will depend on the amount of resources, RAM and CPU in your system. Now, short-term scheduling, this is what we will actually study in this. This is all I will say about the long-term scheduling aspect. The short-term scheduling is the problem of all the processes that are currently running, which one gets to run next. Okay, that's the short-term scheduling problem. That's just the problem of saying which of these from the ready queue do I pick and run on my processor. Okay, it's not how many processes do I let you to create, that's a long-term problem. Once the processes have been created, how do they actually, in what order do they run and which one gets to go next? Okay, that is called a short-term scheduling problem. Okay, so as I said, there are many policies here. Okay, and there are, we need to first define what is the goal that we want. Okay, what do you want to optimize in the system? Is it response time? Is it throughput? Is it turnaround time? Based on that, you will have to pick the right policy. Okay. So there is some demarcation consideration. There's one more thing I say here. Stop.
So a scheduler basically has to pick the CPU. Scheduler has to run whenever process switches from going to wait. There's a process that's running. If it starts going IO, then the CPU scheduler has an exception to run. Or if there is a filter which also causes the running process to pause. What a process is created, when you delete it as a fourth thing here, which is time the time slot expands, come back to that. But there are two types of scheduler. The system, one is non-preemptive scheduler, one is called as preemptive scheduler. In a non-preemptive system, the scheduler must wait one or more events to occur before it switches from one process to another. It cannot go and interrupt the process by itself. It has to wait for the process to give up the CPU, meaning that it will actually block on IO and interrupt will occur on some other high level event. Okay, in a preemptive system, the scheduler runs and any of those two occurs, or the scheduler itself can interrupt the process, say whenever its time slot expires. So we will actually study two types of scheduling algorithm next time, not today. One falls under a broad class of non-preemptive schedulers.
Okay. The other one falls into this class of preemptive schedulers. Okay. The main difference between the two is that the scheduler have the privileges to interrupt a process that is currently running or not. Okay. Can the OS actually suspend the process that is running, or does it have to wait for the process to give up the CPU and only then does it pick the next process? So these are, there's a very important distinction between the two, as we will see next time. Okay. So let's just pause here for today. So next time we'll talk more about CPU scheduling. Thank you.